So today is Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. This is an interview with Jason E. Johns, who served with the Wisconsin Army National Guard and the Army Reserves during Operation Iraqi Freedom. This interview is being conducted at Mr. Johns' office in Madison, Wisconsin. The interviewer is Helen Gibb, and the interview is being recorded for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Program.
All right.
Shall we start with where and when you were born?
Yes, May 27th, 1976. Born in Dubuque, Iowa, and we lived a couple different places around there, but I grew up in Lewisburg, Wisconsin, and so went to school in Hazel Green, Southwestern, and graduated from there. So,
okay. And family, siblings?
Yes, or? I'm the oldest of five. I've got three younger sisters, one younger brother, all still around, and my mom and dad are still back there. My brother is still back there, as well as one sister, so... Yeah.
And I noticed in your thing you were hunting at an early age. Is that a...
Yes. I definitely, as soon as I turned 12, I went and got my hunter's education course, which back then was once a week for like 6 weeks, I think it was. And yeah, started squirrel hunting, rabbit hunting, deer hunting. So, and now I don't squirrel and rabbit as much anymore, but definitely still deer, pheasant, duck, turkey. So yeah.
What was the education course? What did that involve you doing?
Once a week, like I said, they had basically they had volunteers. I think like 100 guys from the area, you know, and you just excuse me, learn firearm safety primarily, and then at the end of the course, you went out shooting. So yeah.
What kind of firearms do you?
Shotgun and rifle.
And high school?
Yeah, high school, Southwestern High School in Hazel Green, Wisconsin, as I mentioned. I was the oldest of five, so I worked as well. I worked at a supper club nearby my house in Lewisburg, where I had bus tables on the weekends, but I was also very active in sports. I played football, wrestling, track, and baseball, as well as... was leading the musical my junior and senior year, which was the funny part about being the four-sport jock and then the singing part. But was involved with band for the first couple of years as well because I'd been through junior high and everything else. But then with sports and work, it got a little too much. So, but yeah.
What were you as the lead? What were you in?
Little Shop of Horrors. That one I was actually one of the leads. It was Mr. Mushnick, which was the shop owner, and then in Damn Yankees, I was the devil character, so the opposite of so the two leads. So, yeah. yeah. You wouldn't figure it, would you? So.
So did you have? I mean, ideas about post high school? Did you know what you were gonna do?
Yeah, you know, it's the story I kind of always tell everyone is. I knew that I wanted to go into the military, but I also knew I wanted to be a lawyer at a young age. Blame it on L.A. law, I guess. I remember watching that religiously. So I went to a recruiter when I was a freshman with my mom and just get an idea of what was available. And I told him exactly that. I said, well, I want to serve, but I want to go to law too. He said, well, perfect. He said, you know, we offer scholarships if you sign up, we'll pay for undergrad, we'll pay for law school, and then we'll commission you and give us 6 years active duty as a JAG officer. I said, perfect. That sounds like the best deal in the world. Well, between my freshman and senior year, when I was old enough to enlist, the TV show JAG came out on CBS, and I refuse to watch it to this day because it was very unrealistic. A lot of... out in the field investigating, flying jets, so on and so forth. So it made being a JAG officer pretty cool, sexy, if you will. So I went back to that same recruiter, and he said, we don't offer the scholarship anymore. And I asked why, and he said, well, we've had so many lawyers who are already lawyers sign up for the JAG Corps, and so we don't have a need that we need to do the scholarship anymore. So I was like, all right, well, what do I do now? I knew I didn't want to go active duty for 4 years and then school for 7 years. So I joined the Wisconsin Army National Guard out of Platteville. which was the closest to where I was. I started college in Platteville for 2 years before I transferred down to the University of Northern Iowa. But yeah, so that was kind of my, and back then in Wisconsin, you had 50% tuition reimbursement for being in the Guard. So it was one way to, because I was on my own to pay for school too. So it was kind of, yeah. So that's why it was one way to serve, but yet still be getting in at school. So.
And do you have family who are already in the military? Or where did this
My grandfather, who I didn't know that well, but he was a Chosin Reservoir survivor with the 101st. And then my dad was, he never deployed to any combat, but he was 82nd Airborne as well. So, mm-hmm. And then a great uncle, probably more influential though, was, because my dad was like, yeah, I just did my 4 years, whatever, right? But my great uncle, I was very close with my grandfather, who was the only son, had three sisters, and so he had to run the family farm in the 40s. And so he wanted to serve, all his friends and his cousins and everything, but ag deferment, we needed the food too. But his cousin, so I guess you call him my third cousin, yeah, Donald Lombardi was his name, and he lived across the street from us. And in fourth grade, I had to do an oral history interview similar to this. And I chose him because he had served in World War II with the Army and was in the Battle of the Bulge. And so I was asking him all about that. And his story ended quickly because he says, well, I was, running through the timber and we were under artillery attack. And next thing I know, I woke up in a French hospital with a nice young nurse and he'd been hit by shrapnel. So he had a Purple Heart, which he showed me. Bronze Star, which he showed me, of course. And then what he gave me, and I carried this thing around forever, was an old M44, the German machine gun. He had a round, but he'd taken the gunpowder out, right? So it was still the brass and the round. And yeah, I think that was probably the first time I really, I always knew I liked history. In fact, I studied history in college. But that was kind of when it started going towards the military.
And what did your family think of you wanting to sign up?
Back then, because I'd signed up, Wisconsin has delayed entry training, so you can sign up while you're still in high school, and then you leave for basic when you're done, and then you can go to the local guard unit and drill with them. And so I signed up in August of '94, which was the start of my senior year in high school. Well, back then, we were still relatively peacetime, and obviously pre 9/11, and my mom was thrilled, actually, because she was, she knew I was going to be on my own with four younger siblings at home. There was 15 years between me and the youngest. And so when she saw that they paid 50% tuition reimbursement, she knew that would help. So yeah, she was fine at the time. Mm-hmm. Later on, we'll come to that, but yeah.
So you finished high school and then?
Yep, finished high school, finished college. I was with the 229th all the way through college. And then when I started law school in fall of 98 up in Minneapolis, I tried to stay with the 229th because I loved the unit, loved the guys. But it was getting too much to try and get home every month. Because it's just under 5 hour drive back then. Now it's more four lanes, but still. So it's getting a little hard to come back. So I transferred up to U.S. Army Reserve unit right there in Minneapolis at Fort Snelling. And my initial 6x2, this is 94 to 2000. So I finished up my initial six up there. And then, of course, I had your 2 years IRR. But then I graduated law school in May of 01. I moved out to Washington, D.C., literally, what was it, August 17th, 2001, and lived in Arlington. So as you can imagine, what happened on 9/11, I witnessed all that. I hopped on my motorcycle because I was working at a law firm, but obviously they called us and said, if you're not already here, stay home kind of thing, because they were shutting down all the bridges and everything in the metro. So I went up to the top of the hill where the Air Force Memorial is now, and saw everything happen at the Pentagon. I went down to try and help, but of course, you know, I'm not uniform. I was just IRR at the time. So without proper clearance, they weren't letting anybody else on there. So then I went back up to the top of the hill and watched the rescue efforts for a bit, and then decided I better get home and see what's going on. So chaos in D.C. at the time, of course. And then in Arlington, I got back home, and they were saying there might be another plane coming. And I remember, too, I should say, when I was going back home, another attorney who owned the house, and then a grad student at George Washington who was from Britain. She was still there. She hadn't gone into class yet. My other roommate was already at work, and we were sitting there watching the TV and when the towers went down, and she was just freaking out, of course, you know. And and so we just kind of sat there and we were waiting to see what was going to happen, and we just decided to start drinking. And so shortly after 9/11, obviously angered, I got back in on temporary duty status with a unit in Bevoir, Fort Bevoir, Virginia, to help with street duty out there, street security. It was an MP unit. I was 80 at Mike Motor Trans, but they could always use drivers and stuff. So I helped them out. For the next year, worked in D.C. But then I came back to Wisconsin to work on a political campaign for Governor McCallum at the time through the RNC. My plan wasn't to move back to Wisconsin at that time. It was just to come back, get some campaign experience, and then go back out and see about maybe working on the Hill. But I liked being back. It was good. I got offered a job in the Capitol. So I started there in December of 2002. And again, it was like, hey, I'll get some experience as a staffer, and then I'll go back out to Washington. I just loved Washington. And then in February 6, 2003, my old unit, the 229th, I saw orders, you know, came across all the legislators' desks when there's a unit mobilized in the state. And so I called the first sergeant, who was my platoon sergeant before, a couple years before. I said, what the heck's going on? I remember it was a Wednesday morning. And he says, well, we're getting called up, so on and so forth. And he says, where are you at now? I said, I'm in Madison. And he says, oh, he goes, I could use another team leader. I got a slot for you if you want to come back. And I says, when do you need to know? And he says, we leave Friday. I'm like, okay. So I was single then. I hadn't met my wife yet, no kids. But talked to my dad, talked to some friends, and just decided that I still had a lot of buddies still in the unit. So I agreed to re-enlist, called the first sergeant back. He sent me to a recruiter over on Wright Street, Brad Bird. And that night, that Wednesday night, we were there for probably 5 hours, signing all the paperwork to re-enlist. I was at MEPS at 5 o'clock the next morning. I walked in and gave my name and social, and the lady's like, oh, yeah, the adjutant general says we got to get you right through. So went through MEPS again like a new recruit, came back to Madison, packed up my apartment. My brother and my dad came up, helped me pack up my apartment, went back to the Capitol. My boss there had a little going away shindig in the afternoon, and then went out with some friends, and Friday I was at the Armory. And Bird said, I don't know if it's still the case, but he says I'm the quickest contact to contract ever in the state of Wisconsin National Guard, so... Yeah, so Friday at the Armory, Saturday we were at Fort McCoy, and we were there. We were supposed to originally go over with the 3rd Armored Division, but then Turkey changed their mind on letting ground troops come through. They only said you could use our airspace, not our... Meanwhile, there was a ton of equipment and troops waiting off coast. So we got delayed at McCoy. We were at McCoy from February 8th until the first part of May. But the thing was, they didn't know if we'd get the call tomorrow, right? That we got picked up by someone else and this and that. And so we'd go home after the first month and a half. Yeah, basically we got weekend passes. But you go home and you didn't know if you'd be leaving that week. So it was... You said goodbye multiple times. And the joke got to be, yeah, I'll see you next weekend, you know, not knowing for sure. Now, of course, if you went back on Sunday night and on Tuesday said we're leaving Wednesday, the family could come up that night, you know, that's it. But still, you just didn't know. So we got picked up by the 4th Infantry Division. Meanwhile, we've been up there training all the equipment, getting the equipment sent over, which was starting to get a little monotonous, though, 4 months to Fort McCoy, or 3 months. But yeah, we got picked up by the 4th ID. We got into Kuwait on my golden birthday, actually, May 27th. So it's, you know, and acclimated there for 2 weeks. And then we drove up to Crit, which was, 4th ID was based, the generals and the higher brass took over the palace in Tikrit. And then there was an old Iraqi Air Force base about 5 miles outside of town that we moved into because we were combat engineers, combat support, combat equipment. And so they basically wanted us to build that up. So they said, why don't you make that your base camp? And when we got in there, that was, it had been bombed to hell and everything else. So we were clearing out rubble for a while and the old burn pits, which we'll see what happens there. But yeah, so we were just set up cots in these old makeshift shelters there and gradually started to build it up. But then we started getting tasked out with MPs and infantry and kind of had different missions all over. So did my time there. And it would have been, things were relatively quiet the first couple months. You had the mission accomplished but it was in June or July when things started to heat up, and it was no coincidence that it was when Bremer announced that they were disbanding the Iraqi army. And we knew immediately that it was a bad idea. Even the guys on the ground were like, what the hell are they doing? So it was about a month later we started getting mortars, random mortars, IEDs, primitive ones, but starting to get planted. And, I mean, it was really simple. That's your only paycheck. And now you're being told you can't be in the Army anymore. And you go walk down the street, how am I going to feed my family? And there's Al-Qaeda and whoever else waiting to pay you. So, so we were running, we ran checkpoint missions. We ran security on villages when MPs, infantry would be knocking down doors. So we kind of got tasked around, even though I was an 88 Mike, there was hall missions, but there was a lot of force support missions as well, where we were building up around Iraq police stations, go out to a lot of different FOBs, forward operating bases, and help get them built up. And then we were working a checkpoint just north of Samarra, and we were staying at an old Iraqi government building, and it was right off Highway 1, and we'd come in, and we'd started, I want to say it was like on a Saturday or Sunday or whatever it might have been. But there during the day and back, you know, this is, you know, equipment was tight, short. You know, we didn't even have, I should say, we got our flak jackets in June. But we didn't get the Kevlar plates until right probably early October. But they still made us wear them for the appearances, which we were pissed off about because, well, if they're not going to do anything, why are we adding more heat, you know, more weight? But we were working this checkpoint, and it's funny to think about it now. At the time, you just did it, right? But we would check it every morning to make sure the enemy hadn't planted anything in there. We only had 2 mine detectors for the whole platoon because it was just me and my platoon out there. And so we'd have the mine detectors, one on each end, and then we'd just walk, and we'd feel with sticks and everything. And yeah. And one thing after a couple of days, because we had probes, you know, you can tell when there's a line of cars and somebody comes up and they're looking and they're not looking at you nicely. And then they turn around and they leave. And when we'd leave at night to go back to the little building we took over, there was no night security left. And we'd asked about getting some night security. And they said, personnel was too tight, this and that. I said, all right, well, the enemy's watching us, something's gonna happen. And sure enough, about 3 days into it, they had gotten in at night, planted 2 anti-tank landmines. And when we rolled in off the highway, I just missed one, the explosion went, and that rocked me, knocked me out. That's where I got a little bit of shrapnel and my hearing blown out. And then when I came to, my friend John Scanlon was in my squad. His vehicle had hit one. He was in a big dump truck, luckily. But his whole vehicle was up in flames. And so, my bell's rung. I'd taken some from the concussion in my back, and I kind of stumbled out of the vehicle, and he was trying to get out. He couldn't get out. So I and another guy ran over there as well as I could, grabbed him, got out of there. We never did have a secondary attack, which was good. But John got medevaced to Germany because his foot got all mangled up. And then I convalesced in a field hospital for, I want to say, about 8 days. Because my ears were bleeding and everything else, you know, I couldn't hear anything and a lot of vertigo. So I returned to duty and finished my tour. We left in April of 04. But it was right after that. That was kind of the start of more intense attacks and mortars and small arms and different engagements. It was a 2-week period there where I had, not after that, but probably in December, where people didn't want to ride with me because I was just unlucky attracting these IEDs in front of me, beside me, behind me. They called me Near Miss Johns for a while. December was the rainiest. The heat was crazy. It was overwhelming. We got the plane in May, right? I mean, just knock you down. And you couldn't sleep for the first month very well. And just as you're kind of getting used to it, you know, come August, September, I don't say you ever get used to it, but tolerable. And all of course our cold weather gear is buried back in our containers back at base camp. We were out on a mission. It was the November mission, Samara, November, December. And the rain started. And it just was a soupy mess because the ground can't absorb it. We were in a tent because the fourth idea was getting ready to launch a big clearing of the city. So we were outside the city, literally just picked a spot in the desert and just set up a shop. And just water woke us up coming through the tent, going through everybody's stuff. You went to step and it was just mud, you know, vehicle stuck. But probably the worst part though, it wasn't just the rain. It was, you just went from 100 plus temperatures for 6 months to 55 during the day and 30s at night. And all our cold weather gear was back at camp. But we still had a mission to do there. So we were freezing. It was a mess. It was a mess. So, anyway, I kind of went into my narrative there, but
I can ask you questions. I'm going to drag you back out of that. I was actually going to take you all the way back to while you're in university. That's uh-huh. I'm curious to know what it was like doing your, you obviously training mm-hmm. While you're at university, and whether mm-hmm. that was, you know, whether that was a common thing amongst, you know, the students you were with, or whether that was sort of a little bit unusual.
Definitely unusual. It wasn't, well, I mean, in the unit, there was quite a few college students because they're, you know, University of Wisconsin Platteville's right there. So it wasn't a surprise to people. It wasn't uncommon with, like, I was a fraternity. I played rugby, and so I would say maybe two or three of us were, you know, serving. So it was a little unusual there. And then down at Northern Iowa, I stayed with the 229th, but I was 2 hours away, so I'd come back. They had a ROTC program there, but I had already been in the unit, and I wanted to stay with the unit. And I had a roommate who was ROTC. So then it became not as uncommon. But again, it's hard to just... It's, the National Guard pre-9/11 is not the National Guard of today. And I'm not saying we didn't do our, we had our drill weekends and we had our 2 weeks in the summer and we did different things around the state.
But yeah, it was a lot more laid back. It was, all right, be here at 7 o'clock tomorrow for formation. We're gonna do the same old, in the winter especially, right? We're gonna do the same old classroom work. We're gonna do the, we're gonna clean our weapons. We're gonna, that kind of thing. I think, and rightfully so, since 9/11, the op tempo is a lot higher. So back then, it was a good deal, right? I mean, it was help pay for college, and you got a little paycheck from the weekend, and so, we got mobilized in '96 for duty in Bosnia, and that would have been probably April. And I was an RA down at UNI, and so I told them I wouldn't be back for the fall. We were leaving in June. Like, we had orders and everything. And but then in May, President Clinton decided to kind of start drawing down. And so our orders were canceled. But here I was, school's out, and I hadn't registered for classes. I had quit my job. And I'm like, God dang it. So I did go back. I mean, I drove back down to the university and met with the registrar. They gave me exception. I got my classes in. But then I was like, all right, where am I going to live for the summer? But I got it all figured out. But yeah, we did. I mean, that was probably the closest up until 9/11 that there was even a talk of going somewhere, right? Other than AT. So yeah, it was never really, you always knew it could. I mean, as soon as you signed up, you knew it could. But it wasn't realistic, right? It wasn't very likely. So therefore, the kind of, we would have a drill weekend, and it was a chance for me to see buddies I hadn't seen in a month. And you're 19, 20, 21, 22. And we'd stay up all night some nights and then come stumbling into formation, But yeah, I'm sure that happens to some degree still now, but it's probably not as easy to do. So, but it was good. It was good.
And you, where did you go in the summers? Were you just around here, or did you get to go
Typically,
anywhere? Right.
we did Nicaragua 1 year, but typically it was McCoy, Fort McCoy, or since we were an engineer, we had a lot of heavy equipment. We would go do community projects. So, like one summer, the Veterans Cemetery at Union Grove. We built that. Yeah. And what they did is they rotated us all from, we had three platoons in the company. And so we would all take turns going up for three, like basically weekends. So every weekend of the summer got covered. And I say built it, I mean, we didn't build the buildings, but the horizontal work, the earth moving and everything else. One summer we did the big complex out here in Verona, the big soccer complex. That was just vacant field then. What was another one we did? Oh, over by Prairie du Chien, we did a big park over there too. So if we weren't at McCoy, we were doing kind of showing the taxpayer they're getting their money's worth. So, yeah. But yeah.
And you, I mean, not that you would be anticipating anything, but you weren't looking to make a career out of the army, afterwards.
It was always in the back of my head, but if I did, it was going to be JAG, right? So, like, when I'm in college and I did well in college, and I would get, my LT or commander saying, "Hey, you want to go OCS?" Well, no, because if I went OCS, there's no guarantee I'd stay with my unit. Very unlikely I'd stay with my unit. And I was really tight with my guys. I liked being enlisted JAG. And then when I was in law school, it was, "Hey, you wanna go JAG for the guard?" And I was like, "No." Plus, I didn't want to commit to that when I wasn't even quite sure what I was gonna do after law school, where I was gonna be. I knew I kind of wanted to move out east, but I always kept it in the back of my head that, all right, I can always, look at the JAG Corps if I go active duty later or whatever it might be. But I also wanted to go in the Foreign Service. I studied public international law in college and or in law school, and I took the Foreign Service exam. And while I was working here, actually, I took the FSE. And my plan was, after I worked in the Capitol, was to go back out in April of 2003. I was supposed to have my assessment, which is the next stage that the State Department does. But then they said, hey, we know you're leaving. I told them, they said, don't worry about it. When you get back, we'll do it at the next cycle, which would be the following April. But when I got home, you know, it had been a lot different of a tour than you expected, you know, and then, of course, getting wounded and everything else. So I just kind of needed to decompress, so I decided to stay in Wisconsin. So I never did pursue the FSE, but that's okay, because I went down a different path. It worked out great, so, yeah.
We'll get to that.
Yeah.
So you were at Formicoi for 3 months? You said doing a training?
Mm-hmm.
What were the preparations like at that time, and were they preparing for this?
Yeah, tour? Very high tempo, because we were, when we went up there on February 8th, you know, it hadn't been decided yet if there was going to be an invasion. They were getting people, they hadn't had the UN and Colin Powell and, you know, the whole weapons of mass destruction, but they were building up just in case. And so when that occurred, and then when the UN negotiations failed and it looked like it was going to happen, I mean, we went up there with the idea we could leave tomorrow, right? I mean, we were getting equipment ready, getting it loaded on trains, getting all the weapons qualification done. It was very high tempo that first month. And then, of course, the invasion happened, and we're still sitting at McCoy. And it was because the Third Army got told to stand down, and so they actually came in later. But then it was, all right, now what's going on? Are we going? Are we not going? So then it kind of slowed down a little bit. But you got to keep up. You know. So we were doing almost like we were at a drill weekend. We were doing classroom work. We were doing equipment operations at McCoy, just pushing dirt around, doing this, doing that. Still doing weapons, you know, just keeping up on the weapons, doing PT, of course. So, but it was more of a, almost like active duty posting at that point. You were just kind of 8 to 5 and, you know, and then see, you know. So, but yeah, that first month and a half was go. So, yeah. But then, like I said, too, we were sitting there and our equipment's already gone. Our equipment had been sent over to Kuwait. So it's sitting over there and we didn't know if we were going to get told to stand down, if we were going. And so, yeah, it was kind of strange. It was also strange, too. I remember thinking, so we're here at Fort McCoy in February, which obviously is very cold, very snowy. And the Army, in its infinite wisdom, there was an MP unit out of a reserve unit out of Puerto Rico. And they sent them there to mob up to go to Iraq. Those poor bastards were freezing. Yeah, go figure. So.
Okay. And so, I mean, obviously you'd have been aware of sort of all of the build-up, but how did that sort of compare with once you actually got over there? You know, how much did that knowledge help you, or, you know?
Yeah. I would say the mobilization wasn't so much necessary as far as, I mean, we'd all been, you know, in the unit off and on for years, right? More on, myself still in, but in different units. So we knew each other, the cohesion was there. It wasn't like anything changed from the operating of our equipment and firing a weapon that, you know, during that time. It's not like you were learning it for the first time. So really, I think if there was anything that prepared us during that mob up, it would have really been just getting in the mindset. The physical fitness as well, obviously, was very helpful when you hit the ground and it's 140 out. But no, in general, I think it was just getting, instead of being in the, and again, too, going back to what I was saying, military discipline wasn't, it was there for formation on drill weekends, but it wasn't necessarily there for the whole weekend. So it got you kind of back into that mind frame. And so, yeah, it was more of, I think, of a more of a mental preparation and then a physical preparation too, but not so much, you know, I forgot how to fire my weapon. It's a good thing we moved up, you know, or I forgot how to drive that truck or that skid loader or that dump, you know, bulldozer. So, yeah, I mean, it was more, we just wanted to, we were getting to the point after being there that long, it was either send us over or send us fucking home, right? I mean, it was getting monotonous. So, but yeah.
And family.
Yeah.
You said you spoke to your dad and...
Yeah. Yeah, at the time. That was the thing was, you know, I had called a real close buddy who'd never served, but... And he says, why would you want to volunteer, right? And I said, well, Jason, his name is Jason, too. I said, I tell you, and he lived in Texas. I said, dude, honestly, I says, don't think I could live with myself if, you know, I'm sitting back here drinking beers and eating potato chips on the couch knowing my buddies are over there. And I said, plus, I says, I'm not married, I don't have any kids, you know. I go, you do, so... In a way, I guess I'm going over so you don't have to someday. And he still talks about that. My dad understood. My brother was younger at the time. I mean, he's 5 years younger than me, so he was probably a freshman, sophomore in college. He had a lot of anxiety about it, but supported me, but had a lot of anxiety. My mom was pissed. She was pissed. Because I remember going home the night before I went up to the armory to report to the armory, and because they had a little send off for us, of course, you know, and we were sitting there, and it hadn't quite dawned on her yet that I didn't have to go. I'm not sure Dad explained it to her all that well. She knew I'd been with that unit for years, and she knew they were going, and she knew I was going now, right? And we were having dinner, and it came up at some point. Oh, I think it was because I was like, man, I can't believe it took that long to sign all that paperwork last night to re-enlist. And she's like, what? And I looked at her, and I looked at Dad, and he's like, you know, and she goes, wait, you volunteered? I said, yeah. She goes, so you don't have to go. I said, well, I do now, but I didn't. And... she slapped me. Yeah. She was very upset. I don't blame her. I wasn't mad at her at the time, right? But she was very upset. And then as time went on my tour, and, you know, and back then, too, she started to kind of get used to, I mean, dealt with it. I mean, she had to. We didn't have... It was hard on them because... we didn't have then, you know, we didn't have Skype and we didn't have internet and we didn't have, I mean, we didn't have, the only communication we had back home was the original snail mail, writing letters, which was sometimes the quickest because you could at least, I mean, it would be a 2-week turnaround, but we'd get a sat phone maybe once a month for 15 minutes. And then AT&T started putting up some computer tents roughly September, October. But we had to convoy to get to them. And so it had to be, I mean, it wasn't just like you got back and went and did it, right? I mean, you had to go through a whole mission prep, and the commander would only authorize those every once in a while, because why put everybody at risk to use a computer? So I could get to an email maybe once every couple of weeks too. So there wasn't a whole lot of direct communication, which of course leads to speculation and what's going on and hearing everything on the news. And so it wasn't near as real time as it is now, but so that was tough on him. That was tough on him. And I remember I got a sat phone on Christmas, and the day before Chris had been killed, and it was just a shitty day. It was raining. It was muddy, you know, from the rainy season. And then of course with Chris and being Christmas, and I called home. I waited. Well, it worked out. It was like I knew everybody'd be around. So we were 9 hours ahead in time. So I called, and my dad answered. And we were talking a little bit. And then he goes, how you doing? I said, I'm not doing too hot. I said, I just kind of unloaded on him. And then it got quiet. And then my mom was on the phone. And she goes, what did you just fucking say to him? And I says, why? And he goes, he's crying. And I'd never seen him cry before, much less, I mean, heard him on the phone, I guess. But yeah, so it was, and I says, oh, nothing. He just feels bad for me. And then, you know, then I put on the other face, right? Because it's mom. I'm not going to worry her if there's nothing she can do about it. So I was like, oh, nothing. You know, just tired. I was on guard duty all night. It's rainy. It's muddy. Dad just must be feeling emotional, you know, that kind of thing. And I think he might have eventually told her later. But, yeah, so, yeah. It was different then. It was different then. You know, we still
burnt our own excrement and we didn't have a whole lot of hot meals. If we got back to base camp, eventually they had a mess tent there, but it's a lot of MREs, a lot of different war. And you don't necessarily say like somebody who went in 07 or 08 had it any better, right? Necessarily, it was a different war by then. You know, there's a lot more amenities from home, and doesn't mean that the engagements are any less worse, but just it's a different experience. Right? I think, you know, I look at it now with having a wife and three kids. I can't imagine. I didn't appreciate it then, but I think about my buddies who were married and had young kids, and I mean, I'm glad to see now, for those sake of people who are married and have families, and you know that they can get on Skype most days, and that they can email, and that they can, you know, get on the phone and whatnot. So that's good. I mean, that obviously helps a lot of things. So, and not just for the morale of the troop, but for the family, you know. So. Yeah, but then I go, you know what? You just think about Vietnam, or you think about World War II, and, you know, oh, you got a son over there? Yep. When's the last time you talked to him? 2 years ago. You know? So, can't complain. Right? I mean, when's the last time you talked to him? Well, when you got on the train, you know? So, yeah. Different. Yeah. Anyway.
And so what was it like when you were finally mobilized got tipped over? What was the emotions in a sense within?
Believe it or not, it was freaking excitement, you know? I know it's stereotypical. It was excitement, it was relief. Because honestly, there was the big feeling among us of like, all right, did we just waste the last 4 months of our lives to not go, you know? And so yeah, for the most part, excitement, yeah, but we thought, because literally, you know, the week before we went, President Bush said mission accomplished, you know, things are done, the major combat operations are over, so we were kind of questioning too, like, what are we going to be doing exactly? But it also fit if we're going to rebuild, if we're going to build them up, if we're going to, you know, engineers, right? And so we figured, we honestly did figure, we might see the sporadic, you know, Fedayeen or somebody try to mess with us. But other than that, we figured we'd be doing reconstruction, you know. So just happened to be over there instead of in Verona, right, you know. So, but that definitely changed. Like I said, it started to pick up a little bit. You started to get the feeling, but October was when it really changed. So, yeah.
And was there anything once you got over there? Was anything that was particularly surprising, or that you actually weren't prepared for? I mean, apart from
the heat. Yeah. Well, there's no way you prepare for the heat. Number one, I think you'll hear that from anybody who ever served over there.
I wasn't prepared for the civilian welcome, you know, and you look back at it now and you're kind of like, shit, did we squander something there? Because it was nothing but goodwill. I mean, you're rolling through towns and thumbs up and kids running and chasing you, and you know, there was a lot of goodwill that first year, you know, that first, towards the end, it was starting to change, right, of our tour. But that first, you know, made a December, yeah. I mean, it was really, there was a lot of, they were relieved that Saddam was gone. And I, you know, I think if, I don't know how we do it differently, right? I mean, I do know how we could have done it differently a little ways, but we tried to
put democracy in a place where they don't know what to do with it. And I think eventually, yes, that should have been something we would want to instill there, if we're there and they want it. But I think for the initial few years, we should have literally replaced Saddam with another someone to, because they don't know what to do with it. And so all they've known is what they're told. And so all they want is, you know, they want their food, they want water, they want electricity. And a lot of them, again, the mentality was, okay, Saddam's gone, bad man. So happy to have President Bush now. And we're like, well, he's not going to be your president, you know. So it was interesting. But there was a lot of happiness for it because they thought they were going to get a better life. And then it kind of got screwed up. So, yeah. And it's probably even worse now. I don't know.
It's hard. Hard to figure out. You know, I still believe in the why, but the how got fucked up. And so, and I think about friends over there, because I went back in 2010, not in the military though. I went back as I started to do study public international law, and was involved in a group called the International Law Students Association, and they sponsor the world's largest moot court, which takes place at The Hague in the Netherlands, and it's a hypothetical between two countries, but. I'm on their board, and I judge the competition every year, and each country has its own competition among its universities, and then the winners go to Washington to compete against the rest of the world. Well, I got asked by State Department in 2010. They wanted to, as part of their reconciliation over there, they're trying to build up rule of law and everything else, if I would come over and help administer the first time they would do it. And of course, you know, even with two young kids at home, my girls were just born the year before. But yeah, I went over for 2 weeks in 2010, in December of 2010, and flew into Sulaymaniyah, went up to Erbil, which was at the time probably the safest part of, I mean, we had already pulled out majority of troops, but I had a couple of escorts and state came up, but it went well. You know, we had 16 universities compete, and you know, I remember speaking to the students. I don't speak fluent Arabic, but I had translators. And I remember, you know, saying to them how great it was to be there, because to have been there as a soldier and you know, regardless of how you felt about the war, here you are now, Saddam didn't allow this. Hopefully you can take what you learned in this competition and get Iraq back on the international stage. And, you know, there was a lot of cheers for that. But the thing that I think probably struck out to me the most was, here's all these students, and when I say students, law students, as you know, you start right after high school with your legal ed. So a lot of these law students that were judging, not just there, but everywhere outside the U.S., they're 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. And it was so surreal because here we are, we're in this hotel for 3 days in Erbil. Kurds, Sunnis, Shiites, no problems, because they knew they were there to, you know. And I judged this one student who was from Tikrit University. And afterwards, he came up to me and he says, when were you at Spiker? And I told him, and he goes, you probably knew me. And I says, what? You know, of course, this was 7 years before. And he goes, I used to run around outside the front gate and sell cigarettes and ice, and because you know we didn't have ice, so we just buy big blocks of ice from the locals. And I'm like, get out of here. And he's like, yeah, right out the front gate, la la. So, and there he was. So I kind of wonder what's happened to them now, especially with ISIS taking over Tikrit, and now we've got it back. But you know, and then I think about some of the police we trained there in Tikrit, because they found 82 bodies. ISIS, when they took Tikrit, they had a mass execution at our base camp at Spiker. Yeah, so I don't know. I often wonder. There's a couple I still keep in touch with on Facebook, but a lot have kind of fallen off the grid. I don't know if they fled or not. But, you know, and then you think about it in perspective too. It's like I was talking to the dean at Baghdad University, and this was in 2010, mind you. And he said, since the war began, at his university, between students, faculty, and staff, he had 504 targeted assassinations against his people. And not just, you know, walking through the marketplace, one of those. It was literally, they were targeted by the insurgents because they were at the university. And I'm like, and you guys are here? You know, so the will's there. You know, it's just, you don't always see it. I mean, on the news or wherever else, but yeah, that was an interesting return, but I'm glad I did it. So, and I thought we were going to have progress after that, but then ISIS rose up and kind of shit the bed there, so.
So let's talk a little bit more about what you were actually doing while you were in Iraq the first time, just in terms of sort of like day-to-day missions and those kind of things.
Yeah. Like I said, the first couple months was mostly building up that base camp. We'd run out, we'd go outside the wire, but it was to go to the other side, to Krit, to a quarry, and pick up gravel and to keep the sand down and the dust down and whatever other equipment was needed or supplies. So it was mostly run convoy missions back and forth. There wasn't a whole lot of combat missions, if you will, so to speak. And so really the first couple months was just building up the base camp, which was pretty monotonous. It was pretty monotonous. But, you know, then starting in... And then, of course, that was, you know, wake up. We had the old buildings that, well, the windows were blown out and the roofs, some were collapsed, some weren't, but we cleaned it out. And we at least had kind of a structure. And that's where our cots were. And then eventually they brought in some little twin beds that they shipped up. But we, you know, we had one generator and that would go down a lot. But, and, you know, if you weren't on something on post, some mission on post you're building up, we were also rebuilding the runways because they basically had just blown the heck out of them in the middle. So it's big craters and you got to kind of rebuild everything. Because 4th Aviation, all the Apaches were based out of there, and they used the hangars, and they wanted to eventually start running planes. So we're working on that. But then I'd say it was about August, July or August, when we started doing escort missions down to Baghdad with civilians, and then somebody else would pick them up over there, civilian haulers. There was, we had 3 platoons, well, 4 when you count headquarters, but headquarters was always at base camp. But 3 platoons all kind of had different specialties, different equipment, different MOSs. So some were, I know, like 3rd was on riverboat duty. They were down there helping those guys out on the river under Krit. And then my platoon, we got down to Balad. We started fobbing a lot more. We were on force protection, so we were going to Balad. Before it was a big air base that it is now, and we were building up berms around it to help, you know, build up the perimeter. We were going to police stations around there, special forces safe houses, and we were putting up jersey barriers and concertina and kind of trying to help with bomb proofing. And then we'd get the random, you know, checkpoint where they wanted a checkpoint, but they didn't want to, you know, they didn't have the manpower, so they'd say, all right, you guys doing checkpoint this week, so we'd go do a checkpoint somewhere. Sometimes they were roving. Sometimes they were set, like the one we were at in Samarra. I got hit. And then we had, what other missions did we have? We did do some rebuilding in Samarra. Patrolled Samarra a couple times. We had the, into Krit, we had the, as I noted in there, thinking back now on the, we built up the police station, we built up the protection around the police station, then we destroyed the Ba'ath Party headquarters, and then we cleaned that all out, and then there was some demo missions too with the statues, anything basically Saddam on it was getting blown up or pulled down or whatever. What else? So Samarra was probably the biggest operation that we were part of. And it was the biggest probably operation at that time that 4th ID had ever done. It was called Operation Ivy. We built up for about 2 weeks. And then
they stormed the city and went house to house, just clearing out. And our job was to man the perimeter of the city and just take care of any rats squeezing out. So that was probably the biggest one as far as number of troops on one mission, all right? Otherwise, it was platoon here, platoon there, squad here, squad there. But yeah, I mean, so it was a little bit of everything at that time, you know, a little bit of everything. So, yeah.
And you said that the IEDs and so that wasn't really a big thing at the beginning?
No.
It wasn't something...
No, it wasn't.
Kind of ubiquitous.
It wasn't. And again, you know, it goes back to our theories from being on the ground. They just got their ass kicked. They were kind of licking their wounds. But there was also, the army hadn't been disbanded yet. So I think it was kind of a lull, if you will, that we happened to get there right at. And then once they regrouped, and then, of course, once a lot of the Iraqi army folded into their ranks, things started picking up in October, you know, it was September into October, right around Ramadan, which was ironic because we declared a ceasefire to honor their Ramadan, but then we got attacked anyway. So, but yeah, it was right about then. And then too, you know, it was still phone activated, or some were, you know, as primitive as standing behind a building and just pulling a string, you know. Or radio operated. So, that was really the big, that was probably the biggest thing, the most common thing. But I would say even more, I would say as far as most deadly. Then there was the occasional RPG, small arms. But those were more, they weren't taking us on so much as they were just trying to harass us, you know, with some bullets or an RPG out of nowhere, and then they're gone. Mortars was the big, their big harassing thing. They weren't very accurate, but they would, it was, you could set your watch by it, you know, every night they just start coming in, and they do that at night so they could try to not be seen as well. But they weren't as skilled in them as, like, if you talk to Vietnambe, he's going to tell you the MVA was, you know, spot on. But these guys were, I don't know if they hadn't been trained, if they just were too much in a hurry and didn't want to get killed or what it was, but, you know, they had access to tons and tons and tons of ammo dumps, you know, that we didn't even know about, right? But they would literally, one instance that you can use is, so there was these dump trucks that the civilians had, because obviously we're the U.S. government, we hire civilians everywhere we go. And so they're hiring all these local civilian contractors and, you know, to rebuild stuff. But the dump trucks were orange, or they were yellow, or they, you know, they were just weird funky colors. But they'd be constantly on the road, they'd constantly be going by your fob, wherever it might be. And so what they started doing there was literally they'd have somebody in the back of one of those dump trucks. And they wouldn't even be aiming, they would just thum, thum, thum. And you hear the mortars coming in, and it almost got to be, since they're so inaccurate, but it was still, you know, he still had to run to the bunker, but it almost got to be where you almost took them for granted, you know, but you didn't want to be that one you took for granted, and, you know, that's the one that hit you. But yeah, but they would do that, and that truck's moving, so by the time you even remotely try to figure out where it came from, they're gone, you know, so, yeah.
I mean, what was it, just the general threat level that you felt at the time?
Mm-hmm.
Was it what it was, sort of consistent
in,
or is it kind of,
you know, no, it wasn't consistent. Like I would say, if you were on patrol in the jungles of Vietnam, if you were at base camp, you were pretty relaxed. Yeah, I mean, because like Spiker, we were set back from the main road. It was wide open, right? They would have to launch a full-blown battalion-size attack to even be remotely a threat. Mortars couldn't really reach us because we were far back enough from the road. So base camp, pretty relaxed. Fobbing, depended. If you were outside of a town,
pretty relaxed, but you know, a little higher. You guard duties, you're pulling perimeter. If you were in a village or a city, constant, right? Because you didn't know where a bullet come from, whatever. But it was really when you went outside the wire is when it elevated. And then you're constant because you're driving. You don't know what. You don't know what's this. You don't know what's around that corner. So it was more, it wasn't 24/7, thank God. But it was when you were, I would say the most heightened was outside the wire. If you're on a mission, on the road, mobile, going through town, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Patrolling, doing a checkpoint. So, yeah.
And downtime, how did you?
Downtime.
Did you have any?
Yeah.
Did you spend it?
No, we did. At base camp mostly. The downtime we'd have fobbing would usually be obviously at the end of a day if you weren't on a night op, and that was really just sitting in your cot playing cards, the old school way, right? Because any generator we had there was one that we had to bring with us. And it wasn't going to power everybody's little DVD stations, and you know, so it was really just enough power for the lights. Now back at base camp, as we got more bigger generators in our barracks there, where we had our little twin beds I was telling you about, they brought in, we had little TVs, you know, not cable, but little TVs, and we set up, you know, dating myself because this is before iPhones, right? And we didn't have, you know, the digital cameras then couldn't hold up to the desert, so we still took disposable. Like, if you look at all my pictures, they're film, you know, that I would mail home. And then when I got home, those disposable cameras, then I got them all developed. And then I had to scan them into the computer. I was talking to this third grade class one time, and they were like, I was showing them pictures. And they're like, why are your pictures so fuzzy? And I'm like, well, you see. Yeah, so we had little TVs. We had a few little TVs and, you know, some PlayStations. And so we'd play video games back at base. We would, we had a sand volleyball pit we made up. One couple of the cooks, they always had a lot of time on their hands. They made like this little golf course in the dirt, right? I mean, but it was like, they put like a pan and put dirt around it and they had to hit in the course. And they had like two clubs. But, it was a lot of sand volleyball. It was a lot of sitting around, smoking and joking, playing cards. We had, we'd do little boxing matches every once in a while, and then work out. And so, this, we didn't have, I know as of 08, I talked to a motor sergeant who was there in 08, back at Spiker, they had, you know, swimming pool and movie theater and Big Macs and everything else, but not then. So, but it was the old, which I'm kind of glad about, in a way. It was the old school camaraderie, so to speak. You didn't have a whole lot to do on your downtime, as far as access to things. So, you know, you talked and you played cards and you made shit out of each other. And so, yeah, that's about it, really.
I'm just thinking out here. Is there anything? What else did you want to cover? Swimming into Downs Pool?
Yes. That was fun.
Seems to be a
story
there.
Yep. When we first got into Decrit, we went over to the palaces, and the fourth ID had just started moving in there. And so we were going through the different buildings, trying to determine the extent of damage from our attacks, what was safe, what wasn't, and hauling out any rubble. And in his, I guess you'd call it his fitness palace, there was his pool, and no one had been in it in a while, so we got down to Skivvy's, and we swam in his pool, and used his bathroom and did bad things to it, and... So yeah, that was cool. You know, it was surreal for me because, you know, to grow up small town Wisconsin, and there I was, you know, in the cradle of civilization, swimming in Saddam Hussein's pool. It was pretty, cool. Yeah, and then of course in his palaces and just being, you know, where he was there and knowing everything about him. So, and it was unique for me too because
you know, on my team, most of the guys, you know, were younger. They were either still in college or never went to college. And, you know, here I was, enlisted man, but I already had my law degree for 3 years at that point, 2 years at that point. And I'd studied public international law, and I'd been involved with that. So I knew the Geneva Convention, and I knew, you know, the UN Charter, and I knew all these laws of war. But yet, you know, I needed to get through it, take care of my guys. But there was always kind of that thing, too. Some of them, you know, like my commander would call me into his tent every once in a while and be like, all right, so you're the most educated grunt I got over here. He says, because he was just he was an engineer, but he wasn't, you know, he didn't know anything about this and that in Geneva. So I'm thinking about doing this and this and this. What do you think? And I go, well, sir, and this is what I try to tell students now that I go and lecture to or that I'm judging or working with, as I say, you know, I said to him, I said, well, sir, on paper, like an express interpretation and reading of this of the convention article, but we're here and we're on the ground and there is deference for that, so I think you're okay. And then other thing, and I ain't gonna lie, there's other times where I'm like, yeah, it's probably a violation, but you know what, fuck it, we gotta do it and get out of here, you know. So it was that kind of dichotomy for me too of, you know, knowing this and knowing that. So, yeah, it was interesting. I was kind of unique in that way.
Yeah, how did you reconcile that? Was it just the fact that you had a job to do while you were there? And
yeah, really, and to get home, you know. And I could also reconcile it in a way where, you know, there was some war crimes. You know, it wasn't like we were slaying people like that. It's just, it really put into perspective something I'd only known as an academic before, and that all these academics and professors and diplomats, they're ready to attack and criticize based on just what they've known here and never over here. And so it did start making me look at all the rules of international law in kind of a different lens, you know. Again, not the hardcore human rights violations, but the, you know, detainment or the treatment of a prisoner, you know, respect to someone's property and livelihood. All right, well, if we suspect that somebody was launching mortars from your house and we knock it down on paper, yeah, we probably just violated something in the ICCPR. But in reality, it's your own fucking fault. You know, so you kind of can deal with it a little better that way. You know? So, and there, you know, it wasn't just on the whim. I mean, if it was pretty clear, you know, was there a time to have a trial and determine? No, right? But if the evidence was pretty overwhelming, you weren't going to sit there and debate what the ICCPR said about knocking somebody's house down. You just did it, you know. So, yeah, so there was just kind of that. And that's what I try to tell, you know, students now, too, and I'm teaching them and talking with them and other colleagues. So I'm still very much involved with that. In fact, I just got back from Mexico City last week. I was down there judging their national rounds. And it was cool because I got to sit on the final round, championship round, with an actual previous vice president of the National Court of Justice. He was very impressed with what we were talking about. But I try to tell everybody is the rules of law are there, the public national, you know, the conventions, the treaties, the charters. They're there, and they're guidelines that we should try to uphold. They really are. But don't read them as gospel either, because they're so fluid, and they have to apply to each situation, and, you know, and it's like, you know, it's hard. What frustrates me sometimes is when somebody says, well, how come the U.S. is ready to take so-and-so to the Hague, right, or to the International Criminal Court for killing 72 civilians, right? Whereas the U.S. commits war crimes every day,
Well, are you talking about a drone? Are you talking about, you know, hitting the wrong place? Are you talking about? So you got to look at it and see where the intent is, see what was led up to it, not just did it happen kind of thing. So.
No, that's really interesting. Yeah. Just giving you a unique perspective.
Uh-huh. It does.
Just seeing, is there anything else that you wanted to talk to us about your time there?
No, I think you know, it was there's good days, there's bad days. You know, we lost it was Chris, we lost some other guys in the battalion that you always think about, but
it's one of those things I try to tell guys too, since I've been real involved with advocacy since and helping guys, is you can sit and think about it all the time and not do anything, or you can live your life and still think about it, but you're doing something, you know? So it's kind of the old cliche, never forget, but you know, don't, they knew what they signed up for. It could have been you just as easy, which some people take that too much. Like, man, it could have been me. Oh my God, it could have been. Well, yeah, could have been any one of us, you know? So you got to kind of keep that attitude. Which I didn't, you know, for a few years, it was tough. I hadn't gotten that attitude yet. I really hadn't. It's really been in the last few years, you know, with starting a family and talking to people and getting involved and doing different events. And so, yeah. I mean, it didn't keep me from earning my living, but it just was always there a lot harder than it is now, so.
And yeah. How did you deal with it in the moment while you were there as a unit? How did you sort of, you know?
You know, amazing? Yeah, it was, as a unit, really, there's not a whole lot of opportunity or time for any mass grieving. You did, you know, you had your ceremony and that was it. You moved on, mission going, you know. But there was always little moments on your own and this and that, or you know, smoking some cigarettes late at night, and you kind of dealt with it that way. But you didn't knock it out of bed the next morning, right? You didn't take your uniform off and throw your weapon down and say, I'm done, send me home, you know? So, yeah, I mean, but it was good. It was good cohesion to do that. We did have one night where we got some black market booze and got really messed up, so, and cried. On a rooftop on a building somewhere in Samara. We're not even sure what we were drinking, so maybe that was part of it, but it was literally, I'm not kidding you, it was a bottle. I think we paid like $5 for it. We got three of them. $5 each. But it was brown. And it had a label on it that looked like it was printed off one of those old dot matrix printers, you know, And it said, the closest thing to Scotch whiskey. And underneath it, it said, made in Lebanon. I'm like, all right, whatever, it's booze. So, because we couldn't have anything over there, you know. So, yeah, so that was one night. And then a different, speaking of that. So, yeah, I can count on both hands the number of times I had anything over there. Because, A, it's not readily available. But, B, we were prohibited from having it. But 4th of July in 03. So we've been working hard, real hard the week before. And we've been out on some FOB missions. And we get back to Spiker. And the LT's like, all right, good news. And this is July 3rd. He goes, good news. No missions tomorrow. You guys got the day off. Like, sweet. So we go outside, up to the gate. I get a bunch of booze from this kid. I come back in. And we go up to one of the old ammo dumps. The ammo bunkers there look like pyramids. I don't know if you've seen pictures of them or not, but the armies, the Iraq armies, they look like pyramids, but they're just, you know, they store their weapons in there and everything else, munitions. And we knew that the Apaches were going to be doing a show of force on the perimeter that night. So we go up to the top of those, and we're drinking. And they're shooting off Hellfires and a 30 millimeter. And we were probably up till 4 in the morning, feeling pretty good. And 6 o'clock, LT comes through and kicks us all awake. Mission came down. Motherfucker. You know, and this is the hottest point of summer. You know, it's 140 degrees out.
know why. And we're just dying. And just dying. You know, and it's not like we drank a bunch of beer. We drank a bunch of stuff that's probably made in somebody's back room. And so we're feeling like ass. And, I mean, you can barely focus on the road. You can barely, you know. And honestly, thank God. And it was the one time we got that bad. Because we didn't get engaged that day. We didn't have any activity. Because I think if we had, we might have been hard to fire. So, yeah, we learned a lesson there, though. Not just from being completely hammered, but trusting that you're not going to have a mission the next day. But drinking in that heat, right? So, yeah, after that, if we ever got a hold of anything, it was maybe a snort here, a snort there. We never, ever got drunk again. So, which made me very lightweight when I first got home. Yeah. Without the bar, let me buy you one. Let me buy you one. And then I don't remember the rest of the night. So, yeah. Anyway.
All right. So maybe, what about your return home then? And we can talk about that. What you've done since.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We had a great welcome home. We had a great welcome home. Went through McCoy. Well, we flew in through Portland, Maine, and then flew into Volkfield. And great. I mean, all our families were there waiting in the hangar, and got to see them. And then it was okay. Your families come up and you spend the night with them, and then you know, in the morning we're going to start demobbing. So then we spent the next 6 days doing paperwork, and we got released. When they were taking us back to the armory, we stopped at all these little towns along the way, and they were out in force, you know, the local VFW and vets and people and flags and the whole way. You know, it's about two and a half hour drive. And then we had the big parade in town. And yeah, it was really everything you think of in a movie, Welcome Home. It was there, you know, and that was pretty overwhelming. I mean, like, they canceled school that day. All the kids were on the streets. Yeah, it was pretty cool. Bible did it right. Shortly thereafter, I kind of got in the political realm here in Wisconsin. I got asked to work on a campaign and did a congressional campaign in La Crosse. And I was still thinking, I'm like, all right, am I going back to D.C.? Am I staying home? What am I doing, you know? And all right, I'll do this campaign, figure it out. And then I met my now wife in November. And I went down to Iowa to visit some friends in Des Moines and met her at a party there. Came back to Wisconsin, got into lobbying, worked in lobbying until 2011, and in between there, I started to get involved. I was at the VFW post in Oregon. I was the commander there for a couple years, and then I started to realize, you know what, I can really do more here in the capital since I was starting to build a career there. So I started getting on all the ledge committees. American Legion, the VFW, and the MOPH, the Military of the Purple Heart. And I do all their pro bono lobbying here in the legislature, which they love, because normally it's the old guy going to a hearing once in a while, but now I'm here and getting, and I'm proud. I mean, I've got a lot of stuff done. I've got a drawer full of pens of bills that I've gotten passed for veterans and that I'm really proud of. And it's kind of leading up to that, is that in summer of 10, one of the guys I worked with on a campaign up in La Crosse, he was the governor's campaign manager when he was still county exec running for the first time. And he called me in like July and he said, hey, the county exec was hoping you get on a phone call with him every couple weeks, just kind of advise him on veterans things. And I said, absolutely. I had never even met him yet. So I did. And then I worked on the bill to make the DBA a cabinet-level agency and got that done in July of 11. And then the governor reappointed, I guess you'd call it, and then appointed me as deputy. And I might still be there. I mean, it's a dysfunctional family over there, no doubt about it. John, if you're listening, I'm just, you know, just kidding, but we all know it is. but the following summer, in between, my wife got sick with our third child, and William, and he came at 24 weeks, so it was a pretty tough time. She was still sick. I held out for about a month. It was April into May.
But I said, you know what, I got to focus on my family, and that's money in the bank, so I could. And so I took the, called the governor and told John, they understood, and took the next 8 months and got everybody healthy and got my, he was in the hospital for 4 months, so we got him out of there, and he's good now. Still a little pipsqueak, but, and then in January 13th, I hung my own shingle, which is what you see now, with the lobbying side of things, and then also now have hired another attorney, Chad, and we do veterans benefits law. So we've gotten accredited with the Office of General Counsel. We're part of the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claim in D.C. We're barred with them. And so we do veterans kind of appeals within the VA. So you know, you got your service officers, which file claims for free. And of course, if anybody ever walked in here, I'd say, have you talked to a service officer yet? And get them pointed in the right direction. But if you, when you get to the point, if you do, where you're now challenging the VA, and it's administrative law hearings, and it's Board of Veterans Affairs, and it's, you know, moving its way up, a lot of service officers, A, don't have the legal knowledge to do that, or B, just are have too much of a caseload. So then they'll refer them to an attorney. There's only five of us in the state that do it, and only two of us are veterans. And so it's also, too, where one thing I try to convey to everyone is the VA, you don't get paid unless the, but I would never charge a veteran by the hour. I mean, just wouldn't. Most people don't. And you don't get paid going forward. So let's say a guy filed in 05. Deny. You win in 11. He'll get that back to 05 in a lump payment of what he would have had as far as disability check. The VA allows the attorney to take 20%, but nothing moving forward. Right now, he's got that going forward too every month. I never charge more than 10 or 15%, depending on the financial status of the veteran, and that's really only to keep the lights on. That's not my moneymaker. That's, you know, lobbying is, but that's what pays the bills. But that's, you know, something I feel like I've been able to do and I should do. Yeah, and then, of course, I've been, in addition to the lobbying stuff, I'm very proud to say that 2 years ago, August of 14, I was elected by the national membership at the National Convention of Military Purple Heart to be their national judge advocate. I became the first 9/11 veteran to be elected to any major veterans service organizations as a national officer in the country. So I'm in my second term of that now, and that's unpaid. That's volunteer. My expenses are, you know, when I have to go somewhere and take care of something or whatever. But yeah, so here I am. I've been married 10 years this summer, and I have twin 7-year-old girls, soon to be 4-year-old son, and things are good. Got all my ratings. Finally, I put off, you know, I was the old, before I knew what I know now, I was the old mentality of, you know what, I got all my pieces, I'm not going to go to the VA, right? It was some of it was pride, some of it was this, some was not understanding the VA, and thinking, all right, if I go get rating, I'm taking money from the guy who lost his leg. No, now I know it's some neutral, and Congress is going to pay it no matter what. But I didn't go until 2011. And it was starting to be, some of it was mental health. Some of it was, you know, PTSD, and it was starting to get pretty bad. And I had a buddy, a Marine, who lost his leg, was a County Veterans Service officer, and he kind of kicked me in the ass, and my wife did too. And I finally went and got all my ratings and everything else and got help. But I remember him lightly slapping me in the face. He goes, all right, so, because we did it in January 11, and I was fortunate having him and knowing what he had. I had all my paperwork, and I was a Purple Heart recipient, and so I by October, I had my connection, and he goes, all right. He goes, so your 60% service connected rating. He goes, that's $1,300 a month, tax free. He goes, it's now. He goes, that goes back to January, so let's just say, you know, it started January 12th is when it started, right? He goes, all right, so 11. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. He goes, 8 years.
He goes, multiply 1,300 times 12 and then multiply it times 8. You stupid bastard, you know? And
he goes, and not just the money. He goes, but, I mean, you had to get to this point where you kind of hit rock bottom before you went and did it, you know? And when I say rock bottom, I hadn't lost my job or anything like that. It was just emotionally and mentally, and I was very short with my children and, you know, the typical. And so I was very angry, very angry. But as you can see now, it's much better. So. And I've put all that kind of effort and anger and emotion into all the veterans advocacy I do, and that's my outlet. And yeah, so it's a proud outlet. There we are.
Well, I'm gonna delve a little bit more into that. Tell me more about the lobbying and some of the things that you've been able to achieve. You mentioned one.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear more about what you've done in the state.
Yeah. So, let's see here. We've got, when you look at the money that's gone to some of the veterans' homes, I lobbied on that. Some of the bills, you know, there's budget things I'm always protecting, you know, with the benefits we have, and the Wisconsin GI Bill. And the Wisconsin GI Bill, I got that changed to where it used to be that you had to have entered active duty service from Wisconsin. We got that changed for those who might move here after their service. As long as they've lived here for 5 years, and have 5 years of tax returns, they can now use the Wisconsin GI Bill. That's one I worked on real hard. We've got the Purple Heart Conservation Patron Bill for the outdoorsmen, which allows Purple Heart recipients in the state to pay $10 to get the hunt and fish everything, which costs $160 for everyone else. We got the Women Veterans License Plate. I'm going to take a sec here because there's a lot more.
That's fine.
Let's see here. Oh, so I'm trying to think backwards in terms of legislative sessions. The credentialing and education. So I had a medic from up north who had done a tour in Iraq, and this was a couple years back, and he came home, and all he wanted to do was go back home, become an EMT. And so he goes in to the Department of Safety Professional Services to get his license. And they tell him he's got to do this whole year-long civilian qualification course, right? Education. And he says, I already did something almost identical to that in the military. And they're like, yeah, but we don't accept the military education. And he goes, and then do I have to do practical after as well? And they're like, yeah, then you got to basically ride along. And then he goes, I just treated triage in a combat zone for, you know. So got that bill passed where now the state has to accept the equivalent training and education in the military and waive the civilian side, which is huge for a lot of guys and girls. So I was real proud of that. What else? Let's see here. Oh, I lobbied on the budget to get the WDVA now has general purpose revenue, where it didn't have it before. So it gets $20 million from that. Let's see here. Worked on the property tax credit for surviving spouses. So now, because basically what you had was, if you're 100% non-employable, you pay your property tax every year, but then if you have taxes coming back, or I mean, if you owe taxes, they'll take off the amount, the equivalent of your property tax off of what you may owe, or they'll give you a credit for next year. So basically, in other words, for those who are in that situation, especially seniors, they don't have to worry about taxes, they don't worry about their property tax. But the problem was, too, was you'd have these spouses who haven't had to worry about property tax for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. Their spouse dies, who's the veteran, and now all of a sudden they're still living in that same house, they gotta pay the property tax. So what the law now does say is you can continue to get the surviving spouse property tax credit as long as you don't remarry, right?
And so, boom. So that's nice. There's a lot of people that really appreciate that one. And I could go on and on. I am so proud of some of this stuff, and I got to think back on it all, right? Because it's like, oh man.
We don't need to go through.
Kind of gives you an idea of what.
Well, I'm curious. How do these things? Are they something that you see that you think that I need to take, or they people come to you?
Some are, just knowing what needs are in the veterans community and being connected over here to find the right legislators to do it. Some have been, yeah, boom, my idea. Hey, I think this would be great. Some have been, I'll be at a veterans convention, you know, VFW or Legion or whatever, and we'll put it to the membership. Say, hey, what do you guys want to see this year? Give us some ideas, that kind of thing. Others are, believe it or not, some legislators come up with their own, which you're like, hey, that's a great idea. I'll help you with that. Or their constituent calls them. And then a lot of them, I'm very proud to say, too, that regardless of Republican or Democrat, I would get along with both sides of the aisle, and majority of legislators over there, if they have a veterans constituent question, if they're thinking about doing a veterans-related bill, they're going to call me first and kind of get my take on it, and then, of course, work towards getting support from the veterans groups. It's a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. Are there any that haven't worked out that, you know, either you're frustrated with or...
Yeah, there is. There's some that have, unfortunately, it's easy for legislators to support a veterans bill when it's no one's opposed to it, right? When it's really just the matter of something better for the veteran at the behest of the state, right? So maybe it's less on the license, right? Or a little less money in that pot. Right, they're willing to kind of do that, but I've had one particular bill regarding asbestos and lawsuits, tort reform in the state, that was being pushed by WMC, a lot of the insurance companies, a lot of the big manufacturers, and our groups all opposed it. So many veterans are, you know, suffering from or been killed from mesothelioma. You know, it was the first time in probably 20 years that all three, the big three, so the Legion, the VFW, and the MOPH were opposed to something, which is over 100,000 veterans in the state, right? So it should have never even saw the light of day. But since all those that wanted the bill write the checks, they contribute millions and millions of dollars, I fought that fucker for right up to the last day of session. But then it eventually passed. We got it amended, made it better. And then the governor signed it without notice behind closed doors. That was very disappointing. Very disappointing.
So that was kind of a reality wake up to. It was kind of disheartening in a way. But that's politics. So.
And is there anything that still needs, that you're still sort of hoping to get through, anything you're working on at the moment?
You know, I got to be honest with you. There's always something that's going to come up, right? Maybe something comes up, might come up tomorrow, might come up 6 months from now. But really, Wisconsin, we're one of the best in the country to be a veteran. I mean, as far as, you know, we've got tax credits. We've got the benefits. We've got the GI Bill. We've got different grants available. We've got, you know, with the property tax credit. There's so many things. I mean, we're right up there with being the most appealable to be a veteran in as Texas, California. Yeah, I mean, we really are. And so, no, there's nothing, like, glaring right now, you know? And, in fact, I've told the groups, you know, we've been so lucky the last 10 years, right? Because of the veteran hoorah, if you will, that it doesn't matter who's in power across the street, whether it's Republicans or Democrats. If we've wanted something, we've gotten it, right? But as the wars wind down and sympathy kind of, you got to watch it now, especially with the way the budgets are, and we can't get too greedy either, you know. So I've been a lot more selective as bills come to me, from ideas come from other people, and it's kind of saying, all right, what can we get a lot of feel good ones that aren't going to cost the state anything, you know, and then get this one big one, or do we want to ask for the whole freaking moon and it doesn't really matter? Some of these don't really matter, but they're going to piss people off. And yeah, you don't want to abuse that sympathy, because, or that, I guess, patriotism, if you will, or support for veterans. Everybody wants to support their vet, but, you know, because we could find ourselves where veterans were, you know, after Vietnam, right? I mean, the reason it wasn't terrible in the 50s and 60s is because you had World War II vets that were legislators. I mean, I know, I got to imagine it was about the same here, but U.S. Congress from 1950 until 1980 was 70% veterans from World War II, you know. But then after Vietnam, you know, that's why you had to see the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims get established. That's why you had to see a complete reform in the VA the last 15, 20 years. And so we got to keep fighting. We got to keep doing it and protecting what we have. But we got to, you also can't get too greedy and ask for too much more until the timing's right. You know, so, but I will say, like, in the post 9/11 era, yeah, there's been a lot done. You know, most people don't realize the Wisconsin GI Bill wasn't around until 2006. You know, so that's one of those things where, you know, you had the post 9/11 GI Bill, the federal, which would pay for 4 years of school, but the Wisconsin GI Bill, and that's if you deployed to a combat zone. If you never did, you didn't have anything other than if you were in the Guard, right? Then you could get the 50% tuition, which when the Governor Doyle then signed the GI Bill, it also raised it to 100% tuition. So if you're in the Guard, if you serve in the Wisconsin, literally you could join the Wisconsin Guard today, 18 years old. They'll pay for your entire college, plus you get books and stipend and a living allowance, and you may never leave Wisconsin. And then the GI Bill, which is beautiful, and I wish they'd had it, because, you know, I'd love to not have my $100,000 of student loans from 3 years of private law school. But with the post 9/11 and the Wisconsin GI Bill, if you're someone who did deploy, if you're 20 years old tomorrow after a deployment, you can go to the University of Wisconsin 4 years for free, all your books paid for, all your segregated fees paid for, and you get a living allowance for, towards your rent. And then you go, you know what? I want to get my law degree. I want to get my master's. I want to get my doctorate. Then you get the Wisconsin GI Bill to pay 128 credits of that. Yeah, so
not a bad deal. Not a bad deal. So so protecting those things and tweaking those things, and yeah.
And so, what about your practice here? Who are the veterans that you're seeing the most? Is it more recent? Is it sort of Vietnam catching up with them?
It's Vietnam catching up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's Vietnam catching up. And which is, it can be frustrating at times because records are hard to find, this and that. Or you'll
see, you know, they'll tell you what happened or see what's going on with them. And if it's presumptive, right, if it's Agent Orange related, boom, you can go help them. They'll get their claim done. But it's the guys who maybe tried the VA in 1981. Right, and we're told get the fuck out of here, or you got nothing. So they never filed a claim. Okay. Now it's clear that they should have, but they were so either just didn't want to, were afraid to, got pushed away, whatever it was.
So now they're sitting here, and you're going, oh, man. And they're like, what? And you're like, your claim is clearly service connected, right? But we're gonna file it today, March 2nd, 2016. And you're going to start getting $1,000 a month for it starting today, March 2nd, 2016. Because it only starts from the day you file the initial claim. And you have to tell them that if they had filed it on March 2nd, 1981, you do the math, you know, and that's frustrating. So, yeah, that's mostly, it's definitely mostly Vietnam's catching up. A lot of the younger generation, my generation, the guys who just served 3 years ago, whatever it may be,
And I say that because I was 26 when I went over, 27 over there, 20 when I got home. But I think about the guys that are in Afghanistan. If you went to Afghanistan right now and you just graduated high school and boot camp, that means you were 3 when 9/11 happened. So, right?
Wow.
Yeah. And so a lot of them, honestly, if you ask a lot of the people in uniform right now that are younger than 22, they learned about 9/11 in the books and watching the news, watching archives, not living it, which is messed up to think about. But no, they...
probably that's where is it going there?
About them in the VA, I guess.
Yeah. The young guys, they're getting caught before they're getting out. They're a lot more tech savvy, right? So they can go online and then go, all right, so the VA has a thing called a fully developed claim now. I've got my paperwork. I'll fill it out. Maybe I'll go talk to a service officer quick, double check it, send it in, right? A lot of the FDCs are getting approved pretty handily if you've got the clear documentation. But there's no basis for them to challenge it, And it saves them money, helps with the backlog, so on and so forth. Now, later on, those guys might be coming back and looking to get those increased, right? But right now, in general, they're getting taken care of. Now, whether they're getting the help they need necessarily every time, right, or the medical appointment they need is another story. But I would say the mass majority are getting the disability. And the reason being, too, is a lot of them, if they were injured on active duty, which they clearly were, they might still be on active duty. So DOD's already done the paperwork, done the medical, and if they get medically retired, they can take their DOD medically retirement papers, walk right over to the VA, and the VA has to accept it. Done. So now they got their rating, they're good. DOD wasn't very good at that in Vietnam either, right? You could be in Japan for a month recovering from a gunshot wound, get sent home, and next thing you know, you're standing at an airport in San Francisco, and you got to find your way back to Wisconsin. So, yeah. So it's a little bit of more awareness, but also the DOD being better, too.
Okay. Well, what are the main sort of reasons they are coming to you, though, the Vietnam ones, is it?
It's mostly they're things that they never thought about before, right, that are related to their service. Might be there's a lot of heart arrhythmias, there's a lot of strokes going on, and they're things that, hey, you know what? Yeah, I was around Agent Orange. I didn't think about it then. I was fine, whatever. Or it's, I fell off the truck and busted up my back, but I was able to work for 40 years after that, right? Now it's killing them, right? It's the things that weren't as traumatic at the time. But if they'd gotten the claim in, they'd be still getting it and they'd be fine. And then it would probably increase as it deteriorates. But now they're trying to come in and they're starting to say, I fell off a truck. We had mortars coming in. We were on the road and, out in the jungle. I fell off the truck. So I didn't get a Purple Heart. I didn't get, medical documentation that I'd been wounded. I fell off the truck. And now how the hell are you going to go back and prove that, right? Whereas now, you fall off a truck. You're going to the medic. Medic's writing up paperwork, they're sending paperwork into your file, your file's going to headquarters, it's going there, it's waiting when you're done, there you go, right? And a lot of times it's even, all right, we're going to treat you, you can no longer be in the service, we're going to medically retire you. It's a lot of it's done for you now, and so it's, you're getting a lot of those, the little things that clearly would be documented today, but weren't then. And now you're trying to document it because it's starting to be a problem now. So, and there's, believe it or not, too, there's a lot of guys coming in for PTSD ratings that never, there wasn't awareness. I mean, there was, but not like there is now. They weren't believed, And so they're starting to get those ratings now. But again, we do appeals, right? Business-wise, we do appeals.
I'll point these guys in the right direction. I'll point them to a service officer. Or I'll point them to the right paperwork. But again, going back to that is, they might be coming in for it, but it's their initial claim. Even if you go, I mean, even if you're sitting across from that VA comp pen, you know, guy who's determining your percentage, and he knows, you know, you say, yeah, I was in Quezon for 2 months in the siege of Quezon. And he's like, damn, that must, clearly you had issues with that, PTSD, right? Yeah, absolutely. And he's going, there's not a damn thing I can do about it because you didn't file a claim when you got home, right? You're filing a claim today. I'm going to give you 50%, but it's from today, right? So, yeah. And for a lot of those guys, it's a nice little retirement addition. You know, it's nice. It's finally getting something. But for some of them who have more severe medical problems, hopefully we can get that rating so they can get treated. That's the most important part. I don't care whether it's 0% or 100%. You know, you're not paying your medical bills for cancer treatment with 10% rating. You can have a 10% rating and get $250 a month, which is nice, but you better be able to still get treatment at the VA. And in order, if your income is not right, or you're not 50% or more, if you're not there for that service-connected injury, you don't get treated for free. So it's... Now, I've been doing the VA law side of things for 2 years, and I'm still learning stuff every day, every day.
Mm-hmm. So. Okay.
Yeah, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about? I mean, we usually just sort of wrap up just asking you about, you know, your service and reflecting back on it and, you know, if this is family listening in the future or just people, you know, trying to kind of project forward, you know, what would you want to know about, you know, your role in your service and afterwards?
Yeah. I think the most important thing is, which I've already said, is, you know, I felt the duty to go, and I'm it's still the toughest, proudest thing I've ever done. But I would do it again. I really would. And I would also say too that when you get back and you're out of uniform and you're back in the civilian world, and that camaraderie's gone, and okay, what's your purpose now? Because you had a purpose then. It's to find it, right? Mine is helping other veterans, you know? And so I've put my passion into that, and I say the lobbying side and other legal work is just so I can pay the bills and pay to help, you know, do the other stuff that I don't get paid for. So just find a purpose. I mean, that's whether it's that or whether it's your purpose is, you know, feeding dogs at the humane shelter. You got to find a purpose because we were trained to have a purpose and to have a mission. And when you don't have one, you know, so, and I would tell we're pretty open in my house with my wife and kids. They're going to grow up appreciating it. So, you know, it's not like, I know you've probably had some grandchildren go, what, Grandpa was in World War II? And then they listen to this and they hear a story. My kids know, and they will know as they get older. So I don't really have a message for them other than, you know, Daddy loves you. But, yeah. And, I get that question a lot. I don't know if maybe other guys you talk to do or gals. Is when your kids are old enough, would you let them join the military? And I said, well, first off, it ain't let, right? Well, would you talk them out of joining? Probably not. Because, I mean, I wouldn't wish some of the things that I went through on them, but at the same time, it's made me who I am. It helped with my education. It made me lifelong friends. It's given me a purpose, you know. So no, I think I'd be the last person to tell them no or forbid it, if they're set on it, right? Am I going to push them into it? Hell no. No way. Not especially since, I mean, hopefully they go to school in Wisconsin, because they'll get to go to school for free because they're my children, and 30% more, you know, 30% or more. But you know, my luck, they'll get into Stanford or something, but whatever. good problem to have, I guess. So no, I don't think I would. I'd be honest with them. I'm going to always be honest with them. I've decided that. I'm going to be honest with them no matter what, as they grow up and everything else, and, you know, and just talk with them. You know. So I got.
No problem.
Oh, and the Wisconsin Veterans Museum rocks out.
We appreciate that.